Enjoy this conversation with David Rizov, where we highlight the differences between PM&R and OMM. We discuss a few case studies, culminating with the topic of hypermobility. So welcome to episode 97 of the Osteopathic Manipulative Medicine podcast, where we share clinical stories and pearls related to osteopathic medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ben Green, a third-year osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine resident at Michigan State University.
And I'm your co-host, Dr. Jordan Little, an intern also at the same residency program.
So our guest is a graduate of MSU Comm, where he was highly involved in the student OMT clinic. In his final year of medical school, he received the Fred L. Mitchell Sr. DO FAAO Memorial Award for exceptional achievement in the field of OMM. Currently, he is in the final year of his PM&R residency at Georgetown University, MedStar National Rehabilitation Hospital in Washington, D.C. There, he founded the PM&R Osteopathic Manipulative Treatment Club. In 2023, he presented a case report at the AAO convocation on an osteopathic approach to refractory sternal pain. He has also presented at the Association of Academic Physiatrists annual meeting on osteopathic manipulative treatment in the treatment of lower back muscle spasms prior to epidural steroid injection for lumbar radiculopathy. He is the primary investigator on a research study looking at hypermobility as an alternative explanation for fibromyalgia symptomatology, which we will talk about in the podcast. He is an advocate for our specialty of osteopathic neuromusculoskeletal medicine, and we welcome to the podcast this evening, Dr. David Rizov. Thank you for being on the podcast this evening.
Hey, Ben. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be on.
Yeah, excited to hear your story. We've crossed paths a few times at convocation, and I think it was at the MSU get-together, I think, in last year, wasn't it? We talked about actually recording a podcast. So now we're doing it.
Yes.
Like a year later.
Hey, don't short us. It was about 8 months. We got there.
That's right. So yeah, thanks for taking the time to be on tonight. So let's just jump right in, get to know you as a person, or give you the opportunity to share your persona with our audience. So if you had to describe yourself in a sentence or two, what would you say?
The way I would describe myself is someone that tries to be really neutral, try to maintain kind of calmness and moments of angst and try to be a mediator between people. I'm often someone that's able to see both sides of an issue. And I'd also consider myself pretty driven. Like when I encounter something that I'm really passionate about, like I really go get it. So those are kind of the main things I would use to describe myself.
Nice. So that's an incredible characteristic, I think, to be calm in the midst of a storm. I think it's a great characteristic for a physician. How do you do that? How do you achieve that? Do you meditate? Do you exercise a lot, like mindfulness? How do you go about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is just kind of like a personality characteristic and just something that you kind of have or you don't have. I wouldn't say I do any kind of like meditation or mindfulness. I mean, I do try to have good life quality balance and, you know, like exercising, doing the things I like, you know, try to reduce stress in that manner. But it's just, you know, especially that kind of neutrality and trying to kind of see both sides of a coin. I feel like that's just something that I've had my whole life, and it's kind of helped me in my medical career, because we all know that there's a lot of chaos that can happen.
Right. That's cool. I mean, is that something you just learned from your parents? I feel like that's an incredible quality to be able to see both sides of the coin.
You know, I mean, that's a great question. I can't really put my finger on what exactly made me like that, but you know, I'm sure the family environment that I grew up in, I can attribute some of it to that. And, you know, I just try to take a step back from things, you know, because there's something I really try to do is just control the things that I can control. Because if you get stressed about those other things you can't, then things can get out of hand pretty quick. So If you just focus on those things that you can control, then you're much more likely to be successful.
Sure. Absolutely. Follow-up question to that, or to just getting to know you as a person. What is the coolest thing that you've ever done in your life?
The coolest thing that I've ever done in my life.
I know you've traveled a lot.
Yeah, I have done quite a bit of traveling. Man, I got to think about this one for a second.
Sorry, I didn't put this on the list of questions to ask
you. No, I think actually, I mean, one of the cooler trips I've been on was when I went to Iceland, and we were able to go down into a non-active volcano. And I guess it's one of the only ones in the world that doesn't have the kind of the top of the volcano closed off. So you're able to descend down into it on this kind of little elevator thing and just kind of see the inside of that. So I thought that was pretty unique. And on that same trip, I got to swim in this river, and it basically, it goes in between two tectonic plates, and you get this picture where you basically have your arms stretched out and you're touching two tectonic plates at the same time. So I thought that was pretty neat. I'm sure there's other cool things that I'm not thinking of, but those two things kind of come to mind, and they were on the same trip.
That's pretty sweet. Iceland is definitely on my bucket list of places to visit. My wife has been there, but I have not. So yeah.
I'm going to New Zealand soon, and we're planning on doing bungee jumping, which is where it was invented, and I'm terrified.
That's so you can do the highest bungee jump in the world there, right?
Great. That's a great place to start, I guess.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, just go big.
Yeah. So that should be interesting. But yeah, cool. We're excited for that.
That's awesome. Jordan, did you have a question?
Yeah. David, question for you. I love adding books to my reading list. Do you have any top-notch recommendations, fiction, nonfiction, books that you feel have altered the course of your life?
You know, when Ben sent me kind of some questions they were going to ask, I know from listening to the podcast that the book is like one of the things you guys ask, and I'm not going to lie, I'm not like a huge reader. I feel like most of my reading energy is spent on the medical stuff, and then beyond that, I kind of focus on other things. So I hate to be a disappointment, but I wouldn't say that I have like some major book that I could, you know, tell you that would, you know, be some mind blowing thing. But you know, I know you usually ask about like movies and documentaries. So, you know, movie wise, one that for some reason I just like really enjoy is called The Usual Suspects with Kevin Spacey. It's a little older. I don't know if either of you have seen it, but it's kind of like one of those, it's kind of an odd movie, but it has like these twists and turns, and the very last scene is just total mind blowing. And I really enjoy watching it with other people, because just to see their reaction at the end, because, you know, at least myself, I never saw it coming. So I really enjoy movies and shows that really keep you on your toes like that.
Mm. So like a psychological thriller kind of a movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So I really like those types of movies. You know, documentary wise, I'm a big sports guy. So I enjoy kind of seeing these documentaries that really give you insight on athletes and their, you know, behind the scenes, and, you know, a couple particular ones, the Michael Jordan one that came out a couple years ago, The Last Dance, I thought that was really well done. And, you know, for me, you know, I was kind of a young kid in the 90s when he was really big. So it was more of like an educational experience for me, learning about kind of that whole decade and all of that. And then we're also big tennis fans. So there's a Netflix documentary called Breakpoint where they, you know, follow different players, and you kind of get some insight on their personalities, which makes it more fun to watch. So those are kind of things I'm interested in. And yeah.
Very cool. It's great. Let's jump into your medical journey. So switch gears a little bit. How did you initially become interested in pursuing a career in medicine?
Yeah. So I know this is going to come as a huge shock as a DO and a PM&R resident, but I was actually initially planning to do physical therapy. And about halfway through my sophomore year, I kind of changed course, and, you know, changed the courses I was taking and switched to some pre-med stuff, to decided to pursue medicine. Cause you know, I think physical therapists are really important and super big what they do for me. It just felt like I also shadowed a lot of outpatient therapists. For me, it felt a little bit repetitive and I wanted to have like a little bit higher level of training. And plus PT school is still like 3 or 4 years anyway. So it's not like you're, it's not like you're gaining much there, you know, so you still a big commitment. So that's why I kind of decided I wanted to go the medicine route instead.
Okay. And DO versus MD, how'd you make that choice?
Yeah, I wish I could say like, oh, I had some awesome experience with a DO going in, but honestly, like when I decided to apply to med school, I just kind of applied to this. I didn't get in my first year. Because I only applied to the schools in Michigan, which is kind of dumb in retrospect, but I didn't get in. And then the second year I spread my net a little wider, I ended up getting into Michigan State. But you know, I go back and think, because I still vividly remember getting, you know, a letter from Central Michigan. I had interviewed there, which is an MD school. Mm-hmm. And I still vividly remember, this is the first year I applied, and opening it and seeing that I had been rejected, and then, you know, getting into MSU Comm the following year and just how profound of a, you know, difference that's made in my career. You know, it's really, really crazy to think about.
Just going through the DO training, being exposed to osteopathic manipulation.
Yeah. Just, I mean, it just now that I've gone through it and I've, you know, and how much I use that philosophy and the hands-on, you know, it blows my mind that I would be able to do it without those tools. So very thankful that, you know, everyone says like, oh, everything happens for a reason. But yeah, it was obviously disappointing the first time around, but I did a year of scribing in the ER, reapplied, and then I got in my second year.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I think... I mean, I do believe that phrase. I think if you're open and you keep walking towards your goals, you'll find your path. And you obviously have found your path and are living a fulfilling career. So I'm super excited for you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We talked about that. Oh yeah. So what was it like when you went into the OMM lab? What was that first lab like? I mean, you'd already gone, you had a little exposure to physical therapy. Were you like, oh, this is kind of similar, but it's different?
Yeah. I mean, once I started learning more about like the DO philosophy and OMT, you know, my interest was definitely peaked. And going to that first lab, I was just really interested. You know, I even though I'd heard a little bit about it, I still had no idea what it actually entailed or, you know, how we could use it. So it was really just curiosity. And, you know, the more we went and talked about and did the labs, you know, the more it just really fit with what I wanted to do, you know, especially with that kind of physical therapy oriented background. You know, and just it was crazy to me, as you know, how many first or second year medical students can say that they have tools that they can use that early in their medical career and actually help people. So that was really, really powerful for me. And, you know, I quickly got super interested in it. Like you said, I dove into doing the student OMM clinic, which is great early career experience. You know, I think we were treating like 2 patients a week, you know, which for a first and second year medical student, that's big. So that's kind of how my early experience was.
Would you say that the student OMM clinic was where it started to really click for you, that what I'm learning in my OMM lab, I mean, it has clinical relevance and I'm seeing patients improve?
Yeah, definitely. I think that was one of the things, you know, like, cause one of the things I struggled with initially, you know, you're learning in lab, like all these different techniques and diagnoses and stuff, and just trying to figure out, okay, like, how do I put this all together? Because it all just seems like a bunch of puzzle pieces, but how do I know what to do when. So the combination of that, Dr. Dillard, I don't know if Lori Dillard, I don't know if you guys are familiar with her. She was like one of my mentors there. I shadowed her in her personal clinic as well. And just got a taste of kind of what, you know, what an OMM clinic looked like, on that side. So I definitely think in general, I think people have mentioned it on this podcast before, but early exposure, clinical exposure, I think is huge, because when you're just learning all these different techniques in lab and you don't really see it applied, you know, I think it's easy to get discouraged or distracted from it. But then you can see just how much people really enjoy it and how much it helps early on. I think that can really solidify it for people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Jordan, I don't want to hoggle the questions.
You're good. You're good. I have a question. So when you were getting that clinical, like early clinical exposure in first and second year, how did you keep the ball rolling into third and fourth year? Like, were there opportunities out on rotations where, like you remember specific examples and patient encounters where you got to use OMM, or how did you keep that ball rolling and the flame burning with OMM?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, kind of like I mentioned in the beginning, like if I'm really passionate about something, I'm going to find a way to do it. So, you know, I really wanted to keep using those skills. And, you know, beyond like, you know, treating family members and friends and things like that, you know, just I think just getting kind of the vibe of the attending you were with and seeing what they were cool with or not. I mean, I rotated at Genesis, which was a pretty DO heavy hospital. So, you know, even when I was on inpatient, I think there were a few times where, you know, a patient had some like neck pain or back pain. And, you know, I asked if I could do that, you know, do some OMT. They were usually cool with it, especially, you know, when you're doing your like family medicine rotations, things like that, you know, usually they're very open to you doing that. So whenever I really could do it and I felt like I was comfortable with the attending and, I would try to seek out those opportunities. And I also did like a dedicated OMM elective. I believe it was my fourth year, up in East Lansing. And that, which was a, you know, cause I didn't get to really experience that clinic in my first couple of years. And it was really awesome to, you know, see such a big OMM clinic and work with so many different providers. So all of that combined and plus going to convocation every year, just kind of kept that passion burning throughout my clinical years.
Nice. Yeah. This is kind of a two-parter question, but as you kind of went through fourth year, what drove you or attracted you towards PM&R?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest. I had about a two-month period late in my third year, right before you just kind of started applying to things, where I was just doing a tug of war in my mind between doing ONMM and PM&R, and I finally came down to it was I felt like if I did PM&R, I could still use as much OMT as I wanted to and gain the other skills that PM&R provided as well. Not just skills, but also you really have a unique set of patients that you get to work with and, you know, a little bit different experience than, you know, working in kind of like an outpatient MSK type scenario. And I think my plan was always to do an ONMM year after I did PM&R. One of my other big interests is MSK ultrasound, and I felt like I wanted to get the training in that as well. And I would maintain my OMT skills and then do the ONMM year to really solidify everything at the end.
Yeah.
It was a tough decision though. I struggled with it for a couple months.
Yeah.
What advice, David, would you give to medical students who are going through that same struggle that you went through? We just had interviews here last week, and it was a pretty common theme that a lot of the interviewees were kind of, they had that same question, you know, do I want to do PM&R? Do I want to do OMM? So what would you say to them?
Yeah. I mean, I think if the only thing that you can see yourself doing in your practice is OMM and you love it and you really don't care about much else, then like, I feel like ONMM is an awesome way to go. If you want to kind of, if you're okay with doing some other experiences, and honestly being okay with not getting much OMT teaching throughout your residency, because most PM&R residencies are pretty not MD heavy, but they don't have, you know, there's a lot of DOs in PM&R, but there's really not many true DO residencies. I think MSU is one of the only ones. So, you know, I knew going into it, I wasn't going to have much education, but I needed to go to a program that was going to be open to me doing it. So if you're willing to do that and you want to learn about patients with spinal cord injuries, patients with brain injuries, strokes, and, you know, develop other skills like ultrasound or doing fluoro, like epidural injections, if you want a much kind of diverse experience, then PM&R is the way to go. But just recognize that those are some of the things that come with it, is that you're not just going to be doing kind of outpatient MSK the whole time. There's a wide variety of things that you're going to be doing, including inpatient PM&R, which is kind of like medicine light at times. So you have to kind of be okay with all that, but also it opens you to a more diverse set of skills, I would say.
Yeah. You mentioned that, you know, you're a very driven person. You get something in the forefront of your mind, you're going for it. And so OMM, like you said, you wanted to keep your skills up. How was it coming up with this idea and actually implementing the osteopathic or the OMT club there at Georgetown?
Yeah. So, I mean, when I was interviewing for residencies, it was something I would ask them, like, you know, this is something I do. And, you know, would you be okay with, you know, someone using these skills? And, you know, that was one of the main things for me. My intern year, I wanted to be able to create something that would allow the DOs in the residency to continue to practice their skills. But also one of the main things I wanted to do was to open the MDs in the program, like kind of open their eyes to what OMT is. And, you know, this is a thing that's out there, and, you know, what might be a good indication to send someone for this? Because obviously within our normal PM&R curriculum, that's not really a thing that's available, right? So my intern year, I got together with one of the second year PM&R residents and kind of pitched this idea, and with the program director too. And we kind of developed a monthly club, you know, just an hour or two where we try to fit like a month of medical school lectures into one or 2 hours, which, you know, it's, you're not going to be able to teach someone, you know, the breadth of OMT that we know with all the training that we've had. And, you know, mostly because there's just not enough time to learn all the palpation, but like at least just showing them a different lens, because, you know, I think especially in PM&R, there's a lot of like gray areas, especially when it comes to like neck pain, back pain, that doesn't quite fit into like the normal algorithm. So if you can approach it with a different lens and at least know like what other things to look for and when to refer them, then I think that's really valuable. And I think people have really appreciated it.
They did appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely.
And you did it for all of the PM&R residents or just those interested in OMT?
Yeah. So it was all the PM&R residents. We have about 20 some residents, I guess 18, if you're not counting the interns, cause they're kind of at the main hospital doing their own thing for the first year. But, yeah, it just kind of opened it up to everyone. Like, this is what I'm doing. If you're interested, you know, come by and, you know, just like learning some of the myofascial techniques and soft tissue techniques, is valuable. And, you know, they can kind of learn some of the things that we do. And I think it's been pretty popular.
Cool. I saw that you also did a talk during grand rounds of when OMT was clinically maybe indicated.
Mm-hmm.
How did that go?
It was good. It was, the grand rounds, it was something that we were kind of required to do as third year residents. And, you know, it was for everyone in the hospital, you know, not just residents. So, attendings, therapists, things like that. So I just wanted, it was kind of like a generalized overview of, you know, what is it? What are some techniques we use and why? And so again, just to kind of create exposure, because it's not something that a lot of people know about, I would say, even in like the physical therapy world. So that was something I wanted to do to kind of create more exposure.
Did you get more referrals after that for OMT treatments, or what were the effects of that talk? Did it just create discussion?
Yeah, I mean, I had some people ask questions at the talk. I mean, it's hard to tell what the true kind of change was, because for my OMT referrals, the only time I'm really able to take patients of my own is in my resident clinic, which is once a week, and I see 3 patients. So availability is very limited. And we already are very booked up just from refer. Like, we have attendings that will refer patients to us. And I'm working as a fourth year, you pair up with a second year, and I'm working with another DO resident. She's a second year. So together we have, you know, we're booked out like 2-3 months right now. So we're actually trying to like slow things down a little bit. So, but yeah, it's hard to see like a lot of patients when you're only seeing 3 patients a week. And, sure. You know, I will, you know, when I do my inpatient, rotations, if, you know, there's a time factor because you're the primary care doctor, on those services, and you know, there's a lot of stuff to do, but you know, if I feel like a patient really needs it or could benefit from it and I got the time, then I'll go ahead and even do it on inpatient, as long as the attendings are okay with it. And they're usually fine with it. I've even had a couple patients follow up with me after their inpatient rehab stay, just because they enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's great. Jordan, anything?
Yeah. With all of your experience thus far, do you have any favorite clinical pearls or stories where you got to use OMT and see some crazy result, or a patient had a crazy response?
Yeah, I think one that really sticks out in my mind, and I'm actually seeing him tomorrow. I have a patient who has thoracic myelopathy, and you know, he's doing pretty well overall. Like, he had some weakness and stuff, but one of the things he deals with is back pain from it, and all that also has kind of this radiating numbness and tingling feeling like all around to the anterior portion of his rib cage, from maybe, you know, like T4 to T10. And you know, when I first started seeing him, it was extremely sensitive over there and numb. And I had been treating him for some other stuff, been doing some other stuff with him, and after a couple of visits, you know, because he had, you know, your normal kind of back pain, muscle pain, so I was like, hey, there's this hands-on stuff that I can try. And I was doing it mostly for his back pain, but in the back of my mind, just keeping in mind kind of those dermatomes and stuff, I was like, huh, I wonder if this will help with the other stuff. And it did. It truly has significantly helped him. And he has almost an immediate response after I treat him, where he'll feel a lot less sensitivity over those areas. And overall, the numbness has gone down. And so that's been a really cool result that I've seen. Probably one of the cooler ones that I've seen in my clinic personally, because it's a little unusual from, like, you know, your normal neck pain, back pain type stuff.
Is that related to that case report that you did at the AAO convo?
No, that was different. But actually, I was thinking about writing it up this year. So stay tuned. You know, it's gonna be the hottest thing at the convo.
can you talk a little bit about that, the osteopathic approach to refractory sternal pain?
Yeah, so it's a patient that I've been seeing for a long time, and it was one of the referrals I got from one of the sports medicine doctors. And what happens usually is, you know, they'll try the normal stuff like PT, injections, and then a lot of times that doesn't work. So then, or if that doesn't work, I'm not saying it doesn't work a lot of the time. If it doesn't work, you know, sometimes they'll send them to me to try some OMT. So this patient, she's had like multiple car accidents, and she just has this very odd sternal pain, you know, not much on her imaging. And, you know, I just kind of going over, you know, the different techniques and things that I tried to kind of help her. And, you know, the OMT was by far the thing that's helped her the most. You know, I think there's some psychological factors and things contributing to her pain as well, but in the grand scheme of things, with everything that she's tried, the OMT was like by far the best thing for her. So I kind of was just kind of delving into her story and some of the things that I had tried.
Yeah. So what technique, I guess, did she really get relief from?
You know, I mean, I did like the normal kind of, you know, treating. I always start by treating, you know, the thoracics, the ribs and things like that. And just really, really trying to focus on, because she, I think on her MRI, she had some edema in one of her SC joints. So really kind of focusing on her SC joints, the movement there, and trying to work on the fascia surrounding the sternum. So, you know, because like, That area is not something we usually, you know, see issues with very often. So people don't, within PM&R, I'm saying, and kind of generally it's an odd place to have pain. So, you know, I think no one really knew what to do with it. You know, she had failed PT. She had a really bad experience with an injection. And so just kind of focusing on some of that stuff. And over time, she's definitely, and honestly, she had a car accident kind of in, halfway through my time seeing her, which kind of set everything back. And I honestly worked more on the cervical and cranial just to calm down that, you know, sympathetic system, because I think I've realized that can play a huge part into people's pain. And when they're really sensitized and don't really want you to kind of palpate much, then that's the thing I focus on the most, to really try to just calm down that system.
Are you doing that at the OA, or do you do like thoracic sympathetic, like nerve inhibition?
Yeah, more focused on like the OA and things like that.
I see. Okay, cool. Great. What else? You wanted to talk a little bit about hypermobility. You have a keen interest in hypermobility, and you're currently doing, you're the PI. of a research study looking at hypermobility as an alternative explanation for fibromyalgia symptomatology. So why the interest in hypermobility?
Yeah, I mean, that stems from, so my second year of PM&R, probably my second month, I did a sports medicine rotation, and one of our faculty then, he's a DO, he unfortunately left like a year later, but I rotated and spent the whole month with him. And I just remember we saw this patient, you know, maybe 40s, came in with neck pain. And after all that, we ended up diagnosing her with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And I had no idea about anything about hypermobility at all. And so this attending that I worked with, he also had a big interest in it. And so he taught me the basics about it and got me more interested in it. And then... So I just found it fascinating, because, you know, as a DO, it really makes a lot of sense when you start learning more about it, because it's really a connective tissue issue, and it affects the whole body. It's not just your muscles and ligaments, you know, affects your vasculature, your organs, you know, it can affect a lot of different things. And so that kind of interconnectedness really just made sense to me as a DO. And there's a huge under education or under awareness in the medical field about hypermobility, and people will go 20 years without getting properly diagnosed. And also my fiance is hypermobile. So I've seen, you know, kind of some of the things that can happen personally. So that's why I kind of have like a personal interest in it as well. And I don't know, I just found it super interesting and have tried to learn more and more about it every year.
Is there any particular aspect that you think is really underappreciated by the medical community, or maybe something that was really interesting to you that you didn't know prior about Ehlers-Danlos or hypermobility?
Yeah, I think it's just it's a condition, and you know, it's a spectrum. You know, there's like joint hypermobility syndrome versus Ehlers-Danlos, and It's all kind of clinical diagnosis. We don't have a genetic marker for the hypermobile time of EDS. So it's all kind of a continuum. And I think the issue is this doesn't fit into any one specialty in medicine. You know, You know, I even tried looking my PM&R textbook for boards, and it's mentioned in like one sentence. And I'm pretty, you know, the other type of specialty that would normally see this type of patient is like primary care or rheumatology, and they definitely barely get any education on it. So it's something that doesn't quite fit into a certain category, but also at the same time, you know, people will have all these symptoms, whether it be musculoskeletal or other, and, you know, no one can figure out like why they're having them. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times they'll be just, you know, they'll say like, oh, like they're crazy, or, you know, their symptoms aren't real, or it's psychologic, where in as a matter of fact, they do have a very real reason to have pain or other symptoms. So I think I've gotten to work with, I did a whole elective with a couple attendings that specialize in this type of stuff, and just being able to meet patients and listen to them and hear their stories, and just realize how much as a kind of medical system we completely fail these types of patients. So that's why it's kind of become a really big interest of mine. And I think my skill set, you know, using osteopathic manipulation and being able to do injections and things like that really fits into being able to try to help that type of patient.
Yeah. Now, why the relation between hypermobility and the fibromyalgia symptomatology?
Yeah. So that attending that I worked with, his name is Dr. Aida. He kind of had this theory that fibromyalgia, which, you know, I'm not sure how much you guys know about it, but, you know, it's a very vague diagnosis. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's not something I think is a real diagnosis. It's essentially just you have a lot of pain and we don't know why. You know, there's some central sensitization aspects to it as well. But, you know, the theory is that a lot of quote unquote fibromyalgia is actually undiagnosed hypermobility. And, you know, we've done research now on about 60 patients. And I would say, you know, obviously this is just preliminary data, but about 50% of them are hypermobile based on the Biten score, which is kind of the main general screening tool we use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you look at the symptomatology between hypermobility and fibromyalgia, there's a lot of similarities. So, you know, I think just therapeutically, just knowing a diagnosis can be really useful for someone, rather than, hey, like you have a lot of pain, versus, hey, there's a real physical reason why you have all this pain. I think, you know, besides the fact that there's other kind of treatment options on top of that, but just knowing what's wrong with you, I think is a big deal. And I think when people get diagnosed with fibromyalgia, it's just kind of like, oh, we don't really know what's going on, but you have a lot of pain. So that was the motivation behind the project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. It's interesting. I'm reading a lot about fascia now. Actually, a research paper, it's a review paper written by physiatrists, actually. Mm-hmm. They talk about how peripheral entrapment, well, first of all, that there are peripheral nerves within the fascia, embedded within the fascia. Mm-hmm. Fascia can be a pain generator. And that peripheral sensitization, when it is repetitive and becomes chronic, can then become central sensitization and then lead to chronic pain. I thought that was really interesting. And I could see how maybe there's a correlation with the hypermobile patient and this connective tissue laxity. I'm just wondering, like, how is that affecting the nociceptive receptors or the free nerve endings embedded within the fascial tissue as
yeah.
well?
I think, yeah, there's 100% a correlation between, you know, the fascia and the connective tissue. And you're right, after a certain many months and years of having that kind of that signal being sent to the brain, you know, it does become more sensitized and it becomes more difficult to treat, obviously.
Yeah.
So, right. So early recognition and diagnosis, you know, you have stories from patients where like, yeah, when I was like 9 and I dislocated my knee and I have no idea why, or I've been having, you know, generalized back pain for like 20 years and I'm 28, you know, things like that don't add up. So, you know, I'm just trying, you know, just like I'm trying to be an advocate for OMT, I'm also trying to educate and be an advocate for that patient population as well, because I think it's definitely underappreciated, and it's much more common than people realize. And, you know, if people are looking for it more, then you'll see it more. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. Are there any educational books that you advise the people with hypermobility to read?
Yeah, there are a couple books. I can't remember what the names of them are. I actually have it. I can get it to you later. I have one of them. I just can't remember the names on it. But there's a couple good books that have been written. One of the authors, she's British, and it's laid out in a very easy to read manner. You know, for both physicians and patients, I think can read it and really benefit from it. But there's two books that are like that. The name is escaping me right now.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, if you want to send that to me, then I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
So if you're interested, they can look that up. Cool.
I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
So with the being an advocate for like hypermobile patients and also advocating for OMT, it's almost kind of paradoxical, like pairing those two, because in OMT we often think like, where is the restriction? What's not moving, and how can we get it moving? And so, how do you go about that, like philosophy, and apply that to someone who already moves too much?
Yeah. And initially when I was learning about it, I thought the exact same thing as you're saying. The difference with hypermobility is because the ligaments are weaker and they're not doing their job, the muscles are working in overdrive and they're basically doing the stabilization work. So that's why the muscles are always angry. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for someone in a hypermobile patient, really stabilization type exercises are really the most important thing. Rather than, you know, like sometimes in PT, they like to really focus on stretching and things of that nature. But stabilization of like the scapular stabilization, pelvic stabilization, those types of things, as well as proprioceptive awareness are really important. But to kind of answer your question, because those muscles are so kind of working overdrive all the time, I think using osteopathic techniques, you know, especially like really indirect things, mm-hmm. To really try to calm those pain signals down. Because if someone's always in pain, you know, when they're trying to do their exercises, they're not going to be as effective. So doing the combination of really trying to use osteopathic techniques to, especially indirect techniques, to really calm down those pain signals. And you know, it's not how you're usually thinking about, you know, like you said, like a restriction, we got to fix that restriction. With muscle energy, right? It's a little bit different. And I'm actually going to be moonlighting at a clinic that specializes in Ehlers-Danlos patients the second half of this year. So I'm interested to see how that goes, because it'll be an educational experience for me as well. But they actually have an ONMM physician, ONMM board of physician there that exclusively does OMM on the patients. So
is that affiliated with the rheumatology clinic, or it's just...
No, it's a private practice. Yeah. It's a private practice in Maryland. The owner, she has Ehlers-Danlos herself, and she founded it. And it's a multidisciplinary clinic that has physicians, PTs, like I said, someone doing OMM. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting combination, and you know, it's pretty rare. You know, they have people coming from like all over the country, because there's not very many clinics that will treat these types of patients. So. It'll be an interesting educational experience for myself as well, just because, like you said, you know, especially coming from Michigan State, I feel like we're very like muscle energy focused, and you know, so I personally feel like I need to work more on my kind of like indirect skills and more gentle type techniques. So it'll be a positive experience for me, I think, as well.
Yeah, we're gonna have to have a round two, David. I want to hear about that experience.
Yeah, I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah. Also, related to what Jordan, what you asked, I think with hypermobility, I mean, I agree with everything that you said, David. I think also that, you know, our joints have mechanoreceptors and proprioceptors, like you were mentioning. Mm-hmm. And when you have that tissue laxity, those receptors are just sending poor information of where the joint is in 3D space. And, you know, the speed of movement of the joints back to the central nervous system. And then the central nervous system, they're getting just bad information from the joint. Then the brain, or the, you know, that arthrokinematic reflex from the spinal cord back to the muscles just doesn't happen properly. So then you get muscle imbalance or muscle overuse. And yeah, I mean, I agree. PT and stabilization, and absolutely, I think you're spot on with the myofascial release and indirect techniques. There's been a number of studies that have talked about myofascial release decreasing inflammatory markers, and you know, indirectly decreasing pain. So yeah, I think that was, I think you're spot on, Dave.
It's kind of like when someone sprains an ankle and your ligaments are a little weaker and your proprioception is a little bit off, you know, going forward with a chronic ankle sprain, and but now make that all over the body. So
yeah,
so yeah, so kind of relearning how to visualize and use your joints in space and stabilizing, so those muscles are, you know, they're not at a disadvantage as much. That's really important.
Yeah, we've had some really cool weekend courses most recently with Dr. Chris Stevenson. I don't know if you've met him at Convocation. He is an internist.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe I have.
Cancer Centers of America. He's walking around last year with the big cowboy hat on. he came to MSU a few weeks ago and taught us basically counter strain on steroids and feeling a therapeutic pulse in the tissue that we were trying to alleviate, you know, myofascial release essentially. But it was really cool. It was really, really cool. So we have been learning some of those, the different approaches, the more soft and gentle, which I think, you know, are very complementary to what we do well here at MSU, which is, you're right, muscle energy.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I'm hoping to kind of gain from my own MM year is to really expand my toolbox and being able to treat all different types of patients differently. So, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to talk about? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Are you talking to me? No, not necessarily.
Got to talk about next year. Like, what are your plans for next year? Oh,
yeah. So next year, I'll be taking my talents to South Beach. No. no, I will be doing an ONMM. I think the proper term is ONMM 3 year at through VCOM with Dr. Kozar, which I'm really excited about because, as I mentioned, my two main interests are OMT and ultrasound, and they are both very well taught there. So I'm excited to do that fellowship and then go on to the next stage of my career after that, and probably move back to Michigan afterwards.
Is that right? You're hoping to come back here to Michigan?
Yeah, it's been a minute since I've been gone, so I think it's time. Although I will admit that mild winters in DC have been nice.
I bet. Yeah, Michigan has grown on me. This place is beautiful. People are great. Low cost of living. Lake Michigan is spectacular.
Yeah, Michigan has a lot of positives. I love, you know, and this is really my first time living outside of the state, so I'm glad I did it. It was a good experience. But outside of the weather, and, you know, don't get me wrong, the summer is amazing. But outside of the weather and the winter and stuff, there's a lot, you know, I definitely enjoy the people there. And, you know, it's a very diverse state. So I think it's an awesome place to live and looking forward to moving back.
Man, I knew your blood was green. I knew it.
Yeah. I only went to Michigan State for undergrad and med school.
Yeah, well, I'm super excited for you next year. Dr. Kozar, he is an incredible physician. I was down there auditioning at Virginia Tech for sports medicine, and I was able to do the night clinic with him.
Yeah, those are intense.
Oh man, it was so cool.
But very rewarding, yeah. I think out of the 4 weeks that I was, I also rotated there, and I think out of the 4 weeks that I was there, I did three of them, and you know, we were leaving at like 11 p.m. at night.
I think we left at 11:30, and then he drove me home. I was like, Dr. Kozar, you want to drive me home? I'll just take an Uber. He's like, no, I'm going to drive you.
Yeah, so. No, he's an awesome person as well as an amazing teacher. So.
He is a wealth of knowledge. So I'm super excited for you. That is just going to be the perfect, exactly what you're looking for.
Yes,
incredible
sir.
Training in MSK ultrasound and stellar ONMM training as well.
Yep. So. Yeah, I've had my eye on that program since like literally med school because of, you know, like I said, if I'm passionate about something, I try to really go get it. So I was happy I was able to match there or get an offer there. So
yeah, that's awesome. You're going to have an incredible skill set when you're done with your training. So the people here of Michigan are going to be lucky to have you when you come back.
Oh, thank you, Ben. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Can I include your email in the show notes so if people want to reach out with you with questions or comments, they can?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Especially, you know, any medical students that might have questions about PM&R or my program at Georgetown, I'm always open to answering questions. You know, I was at the AOC PM&R, the osteopathic PM&R conference last year trying to recruit some students, so I'm always trying to get some people, some more DO students at our program. So feel free to message me.
Awesome. Any other plugs you want to make?
No, I wish I could say I had like some kind of like financial agreement or something to plug, but not at this moment in time. So okay. I appreciate what you guys do with this podcast. You know, it kind of fills my OMM, you know, my OMM like learning or the spot in my mind that isn't occupied with my kind of general PM&R training. So it's nice to kind of hear from people in the field and helps me keep my passion for OMM up as well.
Yeah, thanks for listening and also being an advocate for our specialty of ONMM.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Okay, well, have a great evening, David. Thanks again for your time. And are we going to see you in Convo this year?
I'm undecided, but I am leaning towards going. So if I am, then you know I'll definitely be there for all of it, and I will see you there.
Sounds good. Okay, have a great evening. Thanks again.
Appreciate it.
Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Rizov. It's awesome to listen to someone who loves OMT and is an advocate in the medical community. How many people around us would benefit from osteopathic manipulative treatment but don't know about it? Thanks, Dr. Rizov, for getting the message out there. If you would like to reach out to David with questions or comments, you may at rizovdavid@gmail.com. You can find his email in the show notes. Check out his book recommendations for hypermobility, titled Disjointed, Navigating the Diagnosis and Management of Hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome, and another book, Understanding Hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos Syndrome and Hypermobility Spectrum Disorder. You may also reach out to the podcast with questions, comments, or if you would like to be a guest on the podcast at onmmpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Be well, be curious, and spread osteopathy.